Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And I am thrilled because I get to talk to Dr. Ann Birmingham, a professor emeritus of art at UC Santa Barbara, who is actually curating a show at the most wonderful museum. And it's a treasure that I really urge everybody to take a look at the UC Santa Barbara, the History of Art and Architecture Museum. I've been many times. There's just this marvelous little collection we were talking about in the green room a little bit, the Wunderkammer there. And they do circulating shows. And this particular show really piqued my interest because I've seen so many things in my career that the title of the show alone pulled me in. And I spoke to the powers that be at the museum, and I asked them, could I please talk to the curator I have with me? The title of the show is called The Cave of Treasures, and Dr. Birmingham liaised with Eric Belts, the artist in residence for this show, and the show is, this is what the release says, and I want to talk a little bit about what the show is and how Dr. Birmingham is approaching the show. And so this is also this is the unique method of representing landscape as well as the interest in medicinal and poisonous plants, feminist archaeology, and the evolution of iconography surrounding esoteric symbols. So what that means, I want to find out, but also I want to talk with Dr. Birmingham about her scholarship as well. And thank you, Anne, for being here. I appreciate you coming.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, say, okay, you gave me a high sign. So I did. What did I say that was wrong?
Well, I'm not actually the curator of the exhibition
okay. That's
at the university.
Okay.
It was an exhibition that was put together really by Eric himself.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he, I think, designed the room. It's an installation.
Uh-huh.
And so it's one room, and it has three major pieces of art in it, and then there's some text, wall text, that he's also responsible for. So it was really his creation, his idea,
yeah. And
his themes, one being Medusa, one being the swastika, and the other being poison ivy. All these things that have been charged in our culture,
yes. Certainly
with a lot of negative meaning. And so the exhibition is an exploration of those images and those objects, and an attempt to sort of unpack, I think, some of how it is that they've come to have the meanings they've had, and to kind of, you know, sort of set that out for us to think about.
So how does an image become charged with either negative or positive?
Well, I think, you know, the culture is responsible for that, and I mean, they all have different historical backgrounds. I think the figure of Medusa, of course, goes back to antiquity, and it's a mythological image that has always had a kind of negative connotation. It turns men to stone. Mm. It has, you know, all these kind of fearsome properties. But at the same time, it can then be used as a talismanic object to protect you,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you can hold that head up and protect yourself from any kind of negative evil that's out there. And so it has both this positive and negative aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true, certainly Eric has pointed out, of poison ivy as well. You know, it's terrible for us, but for animals that live in the forest and for other kinds of creatures, it's certainly, you know, a source of food and shelter, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then I think the swastika, which is probably the most charged and the most difficult symbol to deal with, given, you know, the history of the Holocaust. Before it was appropriated by the Nazis, it had been both in ancient Greek and Roman culture, and certainly in Asian culture, been a symbol of abundance and good fortune. So, you know, that's, so what he's playing with, I think, are the ways in which all of these things have these positive and negative aspects. We've tended culturally to code them as negative, but there's a way in which, of course, they always have this other possibility. And so in a way, it kind of works, I think, a little bit the way the notion of a scapegoat works. In other words, we project onto these things a connotation of evil and you know, bad things. But in order to do that, we have to understand deeply inside ourselves what that evil is. In other words, it's already in us. We already know it, and we just project it then outward on these objects and these symbols. But it's something we're very intimate with, and, you know, so
fascinating. So let me see if I understand. So the fact that we have projected a certain negativity or positivity or the whole archetype, which contains both, indicates that whatever is the symbol is triggering, is
we already know
we
it.
We already carry that.
Yeah, we already carry it.
I wonder what other.
I don't suppose poison ivy quite falls under that category, because, there is this way in which it is an allergen for many people.
But I think
Medusa and certainly the swastika too. You know, there's ways in which, the kinds of things that they have come to represent are things that we know deeply, intimately, and we don't want to maybe perhaps acknowledge in ourselves.
But I have to bring myself back a minute, Dr. Birmingham, to a lecture that I attended on ethnobiology and botany by a scholar who studied Chumash horticulture and plants and herbal treatments. And one of those treatments did involve poison ivy.
Oh, really? So
ingesting of.
Oh, so we can, So it works.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like the pharmacon.
It
has virtues that are positive and negative.
And I wonder if he's playing with that pharmacon idea, the way that it does hold the whole polarity, hold both polarities.
Fascinating. Yeah. I think that's what I saw in the exhibition. Eric may, certainly have other, things that he wants to talk about, and that there are other dimensions to it. But certainly that was my takeaway when I saw it.
When you think about your work, we had just a few minutes to talk about some of the books that you've written, but fairly amazing, Learning to Draw, Studies in the History of a Polite and Useful Art. And that won Best Book Award from the Historians of British Art and was named one of the outstanding academic titles for the year by Choice. And then you've also written Landscape and Ideology, the English Rustic Tradition, 1760 to 1860. And you also co-edited with John Brewer The Consumption of Culture, Image, Object, Text, 1600 to 1800. Tell me a little bit about this one book that fascinates me is The Consumption of Culture. Why consumption? Why the word consumption in that title?
Well, I'm an art historian, and John Brewer, my collaborator on that book, was an historian, and both of us work on Britain. We work on 18th and 19th century British history. And we were both interested in the fact that in the 18th century, there's suddenly an explosion, really, of consumerism. And there's an explosion of luxury goods for people to buy. And a lot of it has to do, of course, with the transformation that England undergoes from an agrarian economy to an industrial one. And so the emphasis really was to kind of look at that very carefully, that sudden explosion of commodities and the creation of modern consumerism and modern consumers. And so we had a number of scholars come and give papers on this subject. And so, we had people talking about literature and the explosion in the book trade and, you know, the number of publishers and the kinds of books that are that were being created, you know, for a new class of readers. We talked about art. It was a wonderful year. It was a whole year. It was being funded by the NEH, where all of these people came, gave all these talks, and then we put them all together in a collection. And so that's what that book is about. But the emphasis on consumer, on the consumer, meant also that you could start talking about women and the role of women in this whole, you know, period. Because so much of the stuff that was being produced for women. Clothing and, you know, pottery and ceramics and furniture and all of this. Things that, you know, were intended really to appeal to a new
New
female,
buying class.
A new class of consumer.
Yeah.
And you have, you know, famous potters like Josiah Wedgwood talking to his partner, Thomas Bentley, saying, we've got to produce black basalt teapots because ladies are bleaching their hands and they're going to want to show their white hands off against these nice black teapots.
I did not know that.
It's fascinating. And so it was this wonderful period where, we it hadn't really been looked at, and we just decided this would be a great year to, you know, to spend a whole year just kind of digging into all of this stuff and seeing what all the dimensions were. And so this was, it was an exciting year, and we had a great time doing it.
Fascinating. Image, object, text. I want to know when we get back from the break. Oh, by the way, Dr. Birmingham, Richard does these hand signals, which mean that we have to go to break, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
But I want to talk about image, object, and text and the relationship of those three when we get back from the break. Such a delight to talk with Dr. Birmingham. And just a shout out that she is actually giving a talk February 25th at 5:30 p.m. at the museum. And she's going to talk with artist Eric Belts in conversation about the current installation there, The Cave of Treasures. So this is something to see and also something to hear, because Dr. Birmingham and Eric will be talking about their work there at the University Art Museum. Don't turn that dial. Stay with us. We'll be back.
Say to me how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen. They're not listening still. Perhaps they never. There I was in uniform, looking at the art teacher. I was just a girl then. Never have I loved since then.
Welcome back. This is Elizabeth Stewart, and I'm talking with Dr. Ann Birmingham, Professor Emerita at the UCSB, and also scholar of 18th and 19th century British landscape art. We were talking before the break about the book that she co-edited with John Brewer, which was based on a year-long NEA symposium. Her book is called The Consumption of Culture, Image, Object, Text, 1600 to 1800. And boy, this is just delightful, because I am also super interested in image, object, and text. But before the break, I said, Dr. Birmingham, would you explain the relationship and why the words do not have commas in the title and why they are interrelated?
Oh, I think they do have commas, but it's,
okay.
Yeah. So we were looking at images. We were looking at painting and the art market,
yes,
and how that develops in the 18th century, and, you know, the circulation of images. Certainly, not just, you know, fine art, high art, but, you know, prints and, you know, popular art. And we looked, as I said, at the book trade. So we looked at that, and objects, you know, could be anything from teapots to sculpture to boats, to anything that was being made on a kind of industrial scale that was being produced at that time and consumed. Fashion, we looked at ladies' fashion. You know, so it was a wonderful sort of range of stuff that, you know, we looked at that year and that, you know, we had people coming in and talking about. And it was good.
So the idea of the interrelatedness between, say, text and object, I'm only thinking, you know, how I was, my interest in the material world was piqued. I grew up in a little town in Illinois, kind of a farm town. There was a wealthy farmer's wife, and she was, he had passed away, and she was wanting to sell the farm. And she was quite a lady before she married and moved to our little town. And she had a pair of candlesticks, which intrigued me. And I'd go to the house, and I'd look at these candlesticks. I was probably 11 or 12. And she was saying, well, you know, I know you're interested in stuff, Elizabeth. So when time comes, you know, you and I are going to run a big garage sale and we're going to sell all this stuff so I can retire. And I'm thinking, you know, one day I'm going to buy
those.
I'm
going to
buy those candlesticks. And I did. And I got them home and I was, how do these fit together? How do they work? What are they? What's the material? And I was, by this time, I think 13. And they were ceramic, not porcelain, but ceramic in three parts with a central rod. And they were a bluish cast with sort of pink and blue and purple sort of floral designs, but in a sort of a geometric style. And I thought, I know I've seen this form before. Well, you know, unbeknownst to my son, who's 27 years old, when I told him this story, he said, why didn't you go look, search Google? I said, look, you know, what we had to do in those days was actually go to the card catalog in our little Illinois town, which I did. And I found out that what these were Chinese export porcelain from the 18th century. The reason they were geometric and in three pieces was that, and I think this fits in with what you're saying, Dr. Birmingham, about the crossovers between image objects and text. They were from Canton, and what the Cantonese artisans were doing, they were waiting for the British ships to bring them silver forms. And from those silver forms, they would rethink them in porcelain or ceramic. And therefore, these candlesticks that were porcelain had the geometry of this poured silver. And also they were in three pieces because they were tall. And the boats really basically, that would be damaging to carry such a tall candlestick. So they were made in three parts for the carriage over to Canton and fit together at the end of the trip with a rod. So the Cantonese artisans in the 18th century, mid-18th century, as a matter of fact, would say, oh, well, here's three pieces. Let's cast or pot three pieces of ceramic, and let's join them with a central rod, and let's have them be geometric, et cetera. But then let's ornament them in the family verte or family rose style, which was the style of ornamentation of the ceramic of the time. So you have the crossover between the trade with the ships, the ceramic itself coming back, you see, because we didn't know porcelain the way Asian did, in fact, didn't have that recipe. And that was the interrelationship going back and forth. The image of those objects were of the silver work of the time, but yet they were in porcelain, et cetera. So that was my first study as I was 13, thinking, what is this? How does this fit? What's the relationship between them? And the 18th century has always been fascinating to me, because you, if you see something, a theme in architecture and design, etc., and you go back and you trace the roots of it, usually you can find those roots in artisanal products. In other words, in the cast silver, in the architecture, and often I can find them in early jewelry. Somehow metalwork. You know, even one thinks of the Bronze Age, always metal comes first.
And that cultural cross-pollination is so interesting. You know, the decorative motifs that kind of change and, you know, morph as they kind of across geographical borders, I think is really interesting. And it really, you see a lot of that starting in the 18th century, and part of that just has to do with the expansion of trade with places like China and India and all of those countries that, you know, before had been kind of inaccessible.
Yes.
And so you start finding all this fascinating, you know, cross-pollination going on between different cultures with their decorative motifs and their forms and objects too, certainly.
Yeah. You know, Richard's giving us time. We have to go to break. I'm wondering what if you have any personal, if you are a collector of any 18th century at all, or if you simply your scholarship is from a distance, or if you actually have a candlestick story behind you, Dr. Birmingham. Don't turn that dial. Fascinating discussion with Professor Emeritus Dr. Ann Birmingham. Welcome back. I'm here with Professor Emeritus Dr. Ann Birmingham. And if you're Googling her, she has a different, it's not like Birmingham, England, believe it or not. It's B-E-R-M, Ingham. And we were talking about many things, but remarkably, the consumption of culture, image, object, text, 1600 to 1800, and talking about how this period intrigues me greatly. And I was giving Dr. Birmingham my Chinese export candlestick story. And Dr. Birmingham, do you have anything in your residence of 18th century historical import, and why? And
well, I have some 18th century drawings. I'm interested in drawing, and I've studied drawing. There's some watercolors, and those watercolors were actually collected by my father, who was an amateur watercolorist and loved British watercolor because it's really sort of the epitome of the medium. And then what else do I have? Oh, I have some Staffordshire porcelain, ceramics, hand, pink lusterware that had been, you know, hand-painted probably by children in horrible factory conditions with lead paint, et cetera. But it's very pretty, so it's something I've also collected.
Where did you find those?
In antique shops, you know, and just around, little estate sales and, you know, things like that. So
professors of art history go to estate sales?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, sure.
Well, that's good to know.
You never know what kind of treasures are going to turn up.
I know. I'm a fanatic for them, so yeah. I know, but yeah.
It always feels like such a triumph when you find something, doesn't it?
Yes. Actually, you know, I was talking about my work writing about the collector, and there is a hunter-gatherer kind of division between the acquirer and the connoisseur, and there is that triumphal, I've bagged it feeling, definitely, which is a motivating factor that it's almost, it becomes like a drug a little bit, where you've got to have that. I want to know more about your book, Learning to Draw, Studies in the History of a Polite and Useful Art. And when I read that title, I think, and I'm probably very far off the base, but I think about all my old lady clients who have usually either a wooden box or a cardboard box of Great Aunt Letty's hand-painted slipware, i.e. porcelain, where women would get together. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When we actually had leisure time, women would get together and actually have painting parties on white slipware.
Yeah.
And they're usually awful. They're usually not pretty, and they're usually quite amateur. But sometimes you get somebody who really could paint some of that porcelain. But it's ubiquitous. There's so much of it.
Yeah. Well, I got interested in drawing. I like to draw myself.
You do.
And I had been a studio minor in college, so that was one of the things I had learned how to do. My father, as I say, was an amateur artist. And I got interested in why people who were not professional artists, or had no intention of being professional artists, learn to draw? In other words, you know, when does that happen? Why? How does it start? You know, what kinds of things do they do? And when I was working on landscape, I would go into these British collections of landscape drawings, just kind of go through the stuff and look at, you know, what the, and so much of it had been done by amateurs. And I, this is really interesting, you know, and it's, it, it just had, it was just there in the mix with, you know, works by Constable and Turner, et cetera. But then there'd be all these amateur things. So I thought, you know, gosh, there's a whole raft of, you know, drawings that have never really been thought about. And the practice itself as an amateur practice hadn't been really dealt with. And so, you know, why would people learn to draw and how were they taught? So that's what the book, I mean, that was one of the germs for the book. And I got so interested in it that I realized, you know, this is like a vast subject because people use drawing for so many different reasons and for so many different, you know, purposes. So it goes everywhere from, you know, just sketching for, you know, pleasure and for your pastime and for decoration and, you know, the kinds of things that ladies would be taught to do because it was seen as an accomplishment that a well-educated or well-brought-up young woman would know. She could play the piano, and she could, you know, draw, and she could, you know, sing and do all these things. So it just became one of these topics that grew and grew and grew because it just was so, you know, global. It just seemed to, the tentacles seemed to go everywhere. You know, went into scientific illustration, went into industrial illustration. You could talk about drawing that would be, you know, done by sailors on ships, you know, to pass the time. So there was, you know, once I started looking at it and looking at this practice that so many people were involved in the 18th and 19th centuries, and less so, I think, in the 20th, it became like this huge subject. So, I mean, what started out as this small little project, you know, kind of bloomed and blossomed into some humongous, like, 600-page book. But
fascinating.
Anyway, but even then, you know, I realized there's so much more you could talk about. I mean, you could talk about military drawing. You can talk about drawing being taught to children as a kind of educative tool, you know, something that would help them get a better grasp on the world. And, you know, so there are tons of kind of ways in which drawing was being used and being thought about and talked about and taught. So, and of course, there are drawing manuals, and there's a kind of explosion of those books in that period, too. And I got interested in those as well. So,
you know, I want to ask you, Richard's giving us, so we've got a caller. Put on your headphones. Dr. John's going to help you there. Make sure they're plugged in.
What's this one?
Yeah. When we finish with the caller's question, I want to ask you why we draw. So, Richard, you've got a call for me.
Richard.
Hello.
Richard.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm fine. Elizabeth Stewart.
Yes, sir.
And Anne Birmingham.
Yes.
Hello.
Drawing uses something to draw on, plus something that leaves the mark. Were pencils being made back then? Or chalk like you see in school? Were there stores that people could go and buy the supplies for drawing?
Yeah, for sure there were. Commercialization of the practice really begins in the 18th century. And so you have stationers who were selling books, also selling manuals for teaching people how to draw, selling art supplies like port crayon, which were little pencils that could be used to draw with, certainly chalks, watercolors, and paper. And drawing as an amateur practice really begins with paper and the introduction of paper into Europe, because without paper, you don't have a drawing.
Yeah, you know? Okay, so stationers. I mean, I know that word, and I hadn't thought of it.
Yeah.
I'll hang up and listen to the rest of you.
Sure. Okay.
That's fascinating, Richard. I like that you bring in such a grounding element here. How did it happen? How did it occur? There has to be supplies, after all. I was going off into the deep blue yonder and asking Dr. Birmingham for the esoteric end and the psychological end and the symbolic end. Well, Dr. Birmingham, why do we draw?
I don't know. I don't know that everybody draws, you know. I think it might be something that for certain people, it's a way to kind of ground yourself and experience the world, not just through your eyes, but in a way that helps you kind of interpret in a graphic way what it is you're seeing. And at least I think, certainly I can't speak for everybody. I can only talk for myself.
Yeah.
And for me, that's part of the fun of it, you know. And it's a challenge, too, because it's really about forcing yourself to really see.
Yeah.
Because one of the big challenges, I think, in drawing is that very often your mind takes over. Instead of drawing what you're actually seeing, mm-hmm. you're drawing what you know in your mind. So instead of drawing that cup on a table, you're drawing what your mind is telling you a cup looks like. You're not drawing what that one looks like very often. And so there's this challenge, there's this kind of tug of war, I think, that goes on when you're drawing between, you know, getting your mind to just quiet down and turn off and getting your eyes to really open up and actually see what's actually there. That's always a challenge for me, quieting the mind down. So it's almost a meditative practice in that sense.
But then again, you know, this question of why we draw, I understand the proliferation of manuals and teaching materials coming out of the 18th century, et cetera, and sort of this fashion to be an amateur artist, the 18th century, 19th century, the great age of the amateur anything. Darwin, for example, amateur biologist. But I'm thinking, you know, this idea, Richard kind of put it into my mm-hmm. head there when he said, you, quote, you make your mark.
Yeah.
You see, so you make your mark. That's sort of an interesting comment. And Richard, thank you for that, because mm-hmm. when you said to me, and I could just picture you in amongst, I mean, at the Yale University Library, for example, with all of the watercolors from amateurs there mm-hmm. and all the flats, thinking, these are not professional artists. They're not known artists. Mm-hmm. And I do see a lot of those myself in collections from my clients. Why? Why? You know, why paint that? Mm-hmm. You know, why? Some of them never even made it to a wall, for example. You know, they never even mm-hmm. aspired to a wall. There was just notebooks of mainly watercolor, I see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Why? Why do you think then?
Well, I think, I mean, I can't say for sure, but it seems that there was a value placed on it by society for different kinds of reasons, for different kinds of purposes. I think in the case of men, very often drawing was seen as a way to kind of grasp something and, you know, convey information to
yeah.
to others. But I think for women, there's a whole different economy of drawing going on, and it has to do with a kind of a gift culture. I mean, it has to do with women using drawing very often as a way to give something, to decorate a fan and to give it as a gift, or to decorate, as you were suggesting, you know, pottery and or, you know, ceramics and give that as a gift. So there's a way in which I think the practice for women is very intimately connected with a kind of gift economy in you know, the home and in a kind of domestic setting, and that those things are valued. I mean, it may not look very wonderful, but it's something your daughter made, and you want it, and you want to value it and keep it. And, you know, and I think we all have things that, you know, our grandmothers made or our mothers made, or, you know, embroidery, I think, often fills that role. You know, so I think it has that kind of sentimental value, perhaps, for
the
for
gift
people.
Culture, how interesting. So then, going back to my original question of why we draw. So it is a culturally based phenomena in the 18th/19th century, insofar as men were documenting Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of, you know, Napoleon's Egyptian crusade.
And, or military drawing and map making and all that stuff. You know, I mean, it becomes very quickly used as that kind of a tool, you know, for surveillance and control.
And also in this country, you know, coming over in the 1600s and drawing, Smith drawing the Native Americans, you know, this sort of thing. So it's a, and then so then we go from there to sort of the division of the sexes so that the women were trying to give something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, not that men weren't, too. I mean, clearly, you know, if a talented male amateur was doing things, I'm sure that, you know.
Yeah.
But I think primarily women's work was seen in that context because, you know, women were not expected to be professionals. They weren't expected to be doing
money. That's what I was.
They were doing it because of love. I mean, they were doing,
There's the hook I was looking for because I was trying to think, what is the piece that's missing here?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What about children?
Yeah, children are taught to draw. I mean, and it's seen in the 17th century, children are taught to draw as a way to train their minds, actually, to make them better observers and to make them understand the world in a better way and a kind of, you know, more thorough kind of way. And so drawing begins for children in the 17th century. In the Netherlands, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Then you start finding it picked up elsewhere.
Well, that is very interesting you say Netherlands, because now I'm thinking, so what is the role of realism in that? So
connected. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So that if you are actually being taught to draw in the 1700s in the Netherlands, and you end up going the way of Blake and doing something extremely over the top symbolic. Mm-hmm. As a child, are you told, no, that we don't go there with this sort of thing? We paint what's in front of us. We paint what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. This sort of expressionistic stuff is not happening.
Yeah.
Or was it?
You know, I don't think so. I bet I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't say for sure. So.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow, how fascinating. Oh, Richard's giving us the signal. Before I ask another question to Dr. Birmingham, we have to go to quick break. Don't turn the dial. Stick with us.
Wet paint, wet paint. You know I'm crazy about wet paint.
Wet paint, wet paint.
Can't get enough of wet paint.
Wet paint, wet paint.
Oh, you gotta suck me some of that wet paint.
So I'm having a fantastic time here, if you hadn't noticed, dear listener, talking with Dr. Ann Birmingham. And the book that kind of drew me in to this author, her own book, Landscape and Ideology, I've owned that book for a long time. And I'll give you the whole title, Landscape and Ideology, the English Rustic Tradition, 1760 to 1860. And the University of California Press published that in 1986. And I think I bought my copy. I was a fellow at Winterthur, and I think I bought that while I was researching at Winterthur, if I'm not mistaken. Uh-huh. Tell
it's
me
my
about
juvenilia.
That. Yes, yes. It's your juvenilia?
Right.
I don't believe it.
Yeah.
How old were you when you finished that?
I guess I was in my young 30s. Something like that. So, yeah.
How did that happen? How did that occur? And were you surprised when it was published? Were you surprised when it had the reception it did?
Yeah, actually I was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was. And I was, of course, pleased. It was great. But it was a fun fun book to write. It was actually, it came out of my dissertation that I had written for Harvard. And it was, I enjoyed every minute of writing it. And that was true of the dissertation, too. Mm. And I felt like finally I'm getting to write about something I care about.
Yes.
As opposed to all those papers you have to do for every class you take. And I always liked landscape. I liked it as a genre of painting. I was always interested in it. And I just thought, great, you know, I'm going to do this. So.
Have you, you have to go to another quick break, Richard, pretty soon. Okay, let me get one more question in. Have you changed in your taste? In other words, so in your juvenilia, you had this love, so much so that the dissertation was something you enjoyed doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you changed from your taste in landscape?
I think that it's there, it's broader, it's deeper. So I don't think I haven't moved away from it.
In what way, broader, deeper there?
I think I understand it better, and I think as a result of that, I like more artists' work. I like more.
I hear you.
You know, I mean,
I know.
The more you know, the more you like, you know, so yeah,
or
it's had that effect.
Or sometimes the less, I think, but yes, I do understand that.
Yeah.
And so far as it, I began with watercolor myself. Mm-hmm. I learned to paint, and then I was actually... learned printmaking and collage. And when I finished a course in collage, I realized that I was better at writing about it and talking about it than actually doing it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I turned away from actual studio art. But I understand when I started to collect, and I'm an avid collector of paintings, you should see, I have one entire walk-in closet that's full. But anyway, the mostly landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly landscape, mostly watercolor or pastel, mostly. They are mostly the palette you would expect from the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Today, that palette doesn't intrigue me as much as it did then, and I'm way into sort of very interesting, different colorist versions of landscape. Now, still the horizontal line still captures my eye.
Yeah.
But I understand what you're saying when you say, yeah, you've gone broader with it. Richard, one more quick break? Okay. Some fun songs, I bet. Okay. So we only have a few more minutes with Dr. Ann Birmingham, who is Professor Emerita at UC Santa Barbara. And I want to ask, come to find out, I didn't know, but she actually does like to draw and does draw. And we have a lot of my listeners and our artists.
Mm-hmm.
I get a lot of calls from people saying, oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Advice to people who draw from you. What's your advice to people who do?
Gosh. Well, I think do it because you enjoy it. I would say start with that and start with that impulse. I would just, you know, encourage people to do it because it's a wonderful way to get out of yourself in some sense and start exploring the thing that you're actually looking at and enjoying the whole experience of looking. I think drawing, for me anyway, has just made me more visually aware, and that's a wonderful thing. I mean, it kind of opens you, I think, to the world around you and to seeing things in a different way, sometimes a more complete way, sometimes a more aesthetic way, you know. So it has all these nice benefits that I think are kind of life-enhancing.
Mm.
So I would encourage everyone to draw, and I think doesn't have to be a great-looking, finished product, and I think don't even get hung up on that. You know, just enjoy it as a process, and that's its real value.
And one final shout out for A Cave of Treasures, the show Dr. Birmingham mounted with artist in residence Eric Belt at the UC Art and Architecture Museum until I think it's the end of May, but definitely go take a look and see the installation there, full on installation. And Dr. Birmingham, thank you so much. It was, as you can tell,
I really
love talking with you about
it was fun
your career. Thanks for being here.
But still, your love was true. And when no hope was left in sight on that starry, starry night, you took your life as lovers often do. But I could have told you, Vincent, this world was never meant for one as beautiful as you. Starry, starry night. Portraits hung in empty halls, frameless heads on nameless walls, with eyes that watch the world and can't forget, like the strangers that you've met. The ragged men in ragged clothes, a silver thorn, a bloody rose, lie crushed and broken on the virgin snow. Now I think I know what you tried to say to me, to how you suffered for your sanity, to how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they're not listening still. Perhaps they never will.